As we wrap up 2025, one thing's clear. Uncertainty isn't temporary. It's the world we live in now. Noble Gold Investments helps Americans protect what they've built with real gold and silver, holding value when everything else feels uncertain. Visit NobleGoldInvestments.com and take your first step toward a safe future. This holiday season, when you open up a qualified account, you'll receive 10 one-ounce commemorative silver holiday coins. Visit Noble Gold today.
Past performance may not be indicative of future results. Investing in precious metals, including gold, involves risks. Consult with your tax attorney or financial professional before making an investment decision.
Section 12 of Captain Fracas by Théophile Gautier. Translated by Frédéric de Sumicrast. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Chapter 11. The Pont Neuf. It would be too long and tedious to follow our comedians step by step on their way up to Paris, the great capital. No adventures worthy of being recorded here befell them. As they were in good circumstances financially, they could travel rapidly and comfortably, and were not again subjected to such hardships and annoyances as they had endured in the earlier stages of their long journey. At Tours and Orléans they stopped to give a few representations, which were eminently successful and very satisfactory to the troupe as well as the public. No attempt being made to molest them in any way, Blasius after a time forgot his fears, which had been excited by the vindictive character of the Duke of Valombreuse, but Isabelle could not banish from her memory the wicked plots to abduct her, and many times saw again in her dreams Chiquita's wild, weird face, with the long, tangled elf-locks hanging around it, just as it had appeared to her that dreadful night at the Arme de France, glaring at her with fierce, wolfish eyes. Then she would start up, sobbing and trembling, in violent agitation, and it required the most tender soothing from her companion Zerbine, whose room she had shared ever since they quitted Poitiers, to quiet and reassure her. The soubrette, thoroughly enamoured of Isabelle as of old, was devoted to her, and took great delight in watching over and ministering to her. An own sister could not have been kinder or more affectionately considerate. The only evidence that de Sigognac gave of the anxiety which he secretly felt was his always insisting upon occupying the room nearest Isabelle's, and he used to lie down in his clothes, with his drawn sword on the bed beside him, so as to be ready in case of any sudden alarm. By day he generally walked on in advance of the chariot, taking upon himself the duty of a scout, redoubling his vigilance wherever there happened to be bushes, thickets, high walls, or lurking places of any kind, favourable to an ambuscade, near the roadside. If he perceived from afar a group of travellers approaching, whose appearance seemed to him in the least suspicious, he would instantly draw his sword and fall back upon the chariot, around which the tyrant, Scapin, Blasius, and Leander formed an apparently strong guard, though of the last two mentioned one was incapacitated for active service by age, and the other was as timid as a hare. Sometimes, varying his tactics like a good general, who thinks of and provides against every emergency, the baron would constitute himself a rear guard, and follow the chariot at a little distance, keeping watch over the road behind them. But all his precautions were needless, for no attack was made upon the travellers, or any attempt to interfere with them, and they proceeded tranquilly on their way, without let or hindrance. Although it was winter, the season was not a rigorous one, and our comedians, well fortified against the cold by plenty of warm clothing and good nourishing food, did not mind their exposure to the weather, and found their journey a very enjoyable affair. To be sure, the sharp, frosty air brought a more brilliant colour than usual into the cheeks of the fair members of the troop, but no one could say that it detracted from their charms, and even when it extended, as it did sometimes, to their pretty little noses, it could not be found serious fault with, for everything is becoming to a young and beautiful woman. At last they drew near to the capital, following the windings of the Seine, whose waters flow past royal palaces, and many another edifice of worldwide renown, and at 4 o'clock of a bright winter afternoon came in sight of its spires and domes. The smoke rising from its forest of chimneys hung over it in a semi-transparent cloud, through which the sun shone round and red like a ball of fire. As they entered the city by the Porte Saint-Bernard, a glorious spectacle greeted their wondering eyes. In front of them Notre-Dame stood out in bold relief, with its magnificent flying buttresses, its two stately towers, massive and majestic, and its slender, graceful spire, springing from the lofty roof at the point of intersection of the nave and transepts. Many other lesser towers and spires rose above churches and chapels that were lost amid the densely crowded houses all about them, but de Sigognac had eyes only for the grand old cathedral, which overwhelmed him with astonishment and delight. He would have liked to linger for hours and gaze upon that splendid triumph of architecture, but he needs must go forward with the rest, however reluctantly. The wonderful and unceasing whirl and confusion in the narrow, crowded streets through which they made their way slowly, and not without difficulty, perplexed and distracted him. Accustomed as he had been all his life to the vast solitude of the Landes, and the deathly stillness that reigned almost unbroken in his own desolate old château, it seemed to him as if a mill-wheel were running round and round in his head, and he could feel himself staggering like a drunken man. The Pont Neuf was soon reached, and then de Sigognac caught a glimpse of the famous equestrian statue in bronze of the great and good king, Henri IV, which stands on its lofty pedestal and seems to be keeping guard over the splendid bridge, with its ever-rolling stream of foot passengers, horsemen, and vehicles of every kind and description, from the superb court carriage to the huckster's hand-cart. But in a moment it was lost to view, as the chariot turned into the then newly opened Rue Dauphine. In this street was a fine big hotel, frequently patronized by ambassadors from foreign lands, with numerous retinues, for it was so vast that it could always furnish accommodations for large parties arriving unexpectedly. As the prosperous state of their finances admitted of their indulging in such luxury, Hérode had fixed upon this house as their place of abode in Paris, because it would give a certain prestige to his troupe to be lodged there, and show conclusively that they were not mere needy, vagabond players, gaining a precarious livelihood in their wanderings through the provinces, but a company of comedians of good standing, whose talents brought them in a handsome revenue. Upon their arrival at this imposing hostelry, they were first shown into an immense kitchen, which presented an animated, busy scene, a whole army of cooks bustling about the great roaring fire and around the various tables, where all sorts of culinary rites were in active progress, while the mingling of savoury odours that pervaded the whole place so tickled the olfactory organs of Blasius, Hérode, and Scapin, the gourmands of the troupe, that their mouths expanded into the broadest of grins, and they edged as near as possible to the numerous saucepans, etc., from which they issued. In a few moments a servant came to conduct them to the rooms that had been prepared for them, and just as they turned away from the blazing fire, round which they had gathered, to follow him, a traveller entered and approached it, whose face seemed strangely familiar to de Sigognac. He was a tall, powerful man, wearing large spurs, which rang against the stone floor at every step, and the great spots of mud, some of them not yet dry, with which he was bespattered from head to foot, showed that he must have been riding far and fast. He was a fierce-looking fellow, with an insolent, devil-may-care, arrogant sort of expression, and bold, swaggering gait, yet he started at sight of the young baron, and plainly shrunk from his eye, hastening on to the fire and bending over it, with his back turned to de Sigognac, under pretence of warming his hands. In vain did our hero try to recall when and where he had seen the man before, but he was positive that he had come in contact with him somewhere, and that recently, and he was conscious of a vague feeling of uneasiness with regard to him, that he could not account for. However, there was nothing for him to do but follow his companions, and they all went to their respective chambers, there to make themselves presentable for the meal to which they were shortly summoned, and which they thoroughly enjoyed, as only hungry travellers can. The fare was excellent, the wine capital, the dining-room well lighted, warm and comfortable, and all were in high spirits, congratulating each other upon having happily reached the end of their long journey at last, and drinking to their own future success in this great city of Paris. They indulged in the flattering hope of producing a sensation here as well as at Poitiers, and even dared to dream of being commanded to appear before the court, and of being rewarded royally for their exertions to please. Only de Sigognac was silent and preoccupied, and Isabelle, whose thoughts were all of him, cast anxious glances at him, and wished that she could charm away his melancholy. He was seated at the other end of the table, and still puzzling over the face that he had seen in the kitchen, but he soon looked towards her, and caught her lovely eyes fixed upon him, with such an adorable expression of chaste love and angelic tenderness in their shadowy depths, that all thoughts save of her were at once banished from his mind. The warmth of the room had flushed her cheeks a little, her eyes shone like stars, and she looked wonderfully beautiful. The young Duke of Valombreuse would have been more madly enamoured of her than ever if he could have seen her then. As for de Sigognac, he gazed at her with unfeigned delight, his dark, expressive eyes eloquent of adoring love and deep reverence. A new sentiment mingled with his passion now, ever since she had opened her heart to him and let him see all its heavenly purity and goodness, which elevated, ennobled, and intensified it. He knew now the true lofty beauty of her soul, that it was akin to the angels, and but for the keen, ever-increasing grief he suffered because of her firm refusal to give herself wholly to him, his happiness in possessing her faithful, devoted love would have been too perfect for this life of trials and sorrow. When supper was over, de Sigognac accompanied Isabelle to the threshold of her own room, and said ere he left her, "Be sure to fasten your door securely, my sweet Isabelle, for there are so many people about in a great hotel like this that one cannot be too careful. "You need have no fears for me here, my dear Baron," she replied. "Only look at this lock, and you will be convinced of that. Why, it is strong enough for a prison door, and the key turns thrice in it. And here is a great thick bolt besides, actually as long as my arm. The window is securely barred, and there is no dreadful bull's-eye or opening of any kind in the wall to make me afraid. Travellers so often have articles of value with them that I suppose it is necessary for them to have such protections against thieves. Make yourself easy about me, de Sigognac. Never was the enchanted princess of a fairy tale shut up in her strong tower guarded by dragons in greater security than am I in this fortress of mine. But sometimes it chances that the magic charms and spells represented by these bolts and bars are insufficient, my beloved Isabel, and the enemy manages to force his way in despite them all, and the mystic signs, phylacteries and abracadabras into the bargain. Yes, but that is when the princess within secretly favours his efforts, said Isabel with a mischievous smile, and in some mysterious way constitutes herself his accomplice, being tired of her seclusion, perhaps, or else in love with the bold intruder. Neither of which is my case, you know, de Sigognac. Surely, if I'm not afraid, I, who am more timid than the trembling doe when she hears the dread sound of the hunter's horn and the baying of the hounds, you should not fear, you who are brave as Alexander the Great himself. Sleep in peace tonight, my friend, I pray you, and sleep soundly, not with one eye open, as you have done so often of late for my sake. And now good night." She held out to him a pretty little hand, white and soft enough to have belonged to a veritable princess, which he kissed as reverently as if it had been a queen's, then waited to hear her turn the big clumsy iron key three times in the lock, no easy task for her delicate fingers, and push home the heavy bolt. Breathing a fervent blessing upon her, he turned away reluctantly towards his own door. As he paused an instant before it, he saw a shadow moving, turned round quickly, and caught sight of the very man he had been thinking of and puzzling over so much that evening, whose approach he had not heard at all, passing stealthily along the corridor, presumably on his way to his own room. Not an extraordinary circumstance, that, but the Baron's suspicions were instantly aroused, and under pretext of trying to introduce his key into the lock, he furtively watched him the whole length of the passage, until a turn in it hid him from view, as he gained an unfrequented part of the house. A moment later the sound of a door being softly opened and closed announced that he had probably reached his own chamber, and then all was still again. "Now what does this mean?" said de Sigognac to himself, and haunted by a vague feeling of anxiety and uneasiness, he could not even bring himself to lie down upon his bed and rest his weary frame. So after pacing restlessly about the room for a while, he concluded to occupy himself in writing a letter to his good old Pierre. He had promised to apprise him of his arrival in Paris. He was careful that the handwriting should be very large, clear, and distinct, for the faithful old servant was not much of a scholar, and addressed him as follows. "My good Pierre, here I am at last, actually in Paris, the great capital, where, according to general belief, I am to fall in with some sort of good fortune or other, that will enable me to re-establish the ancient prosperity of my house, though in truth I cannot see where I am to look for it. However, some happy chance may bring me into relations with the court, and if I could only get to speak to the king, the great dispenser of all favours, the important and famous services rendered by my ancestors to his royal predecessors would surely incline him to listen to me with indulgence and interest. His gracious majesty could not, it seems to me, suffer a noble family that had devoted all their possessions to the service of king and country, in many wars, to die out so miserably, if once he knew of it. Meantime, for want of other employment, I have taken to acting, and have made a little money thereby, part of which I shall send to you as soon as I can find a good opportunity. It would have been better, perhaps, if I had enlisted as a soldier, but I could not give up my liberty, and however poverty-stricken a man may be, his pride revolts at the idea of putting himself under the orders of those whom his noble ancestors used to command. The only adventure worth relating that has befallen me since I left you was a duel that I fought at Poitiers with a certain young duke, who was held to be invincible. But thanks to your good instructions, I was able to get the better of him easily. I ran him through the right arm, and could just as well have run him through the body, and left him dead upon the field, for his defence was weak and insufficient, by no means equal to his attack, which was daring and brilliant, though very reckless, and several times he was entirely at my mercy as he grew heated and angry. He has not been so thoroughly trained to preserve his sang-froid, whatever may happen, as I, and I now appreciate for the first time your wonderful patience and perseverance in making me a master of the noble art of fencing, and how valuable my proficiency in it will be to me. Your scholar does you honour, my brave Pierre, and I won great praise and applause for my really too easy victory. In spite of the constant novelty and excitement of my new way of life, my thoughts often return to dwell upon my poor old chateau, crumbling gradually into ruin over the tombs of my ancestors. From afar it does not seem so desolate and forlorn, and there are times when I fancy myself there once more, gazing up at the venerable family portraits, wandering through the deserted rooms, and I find a sort of melancholy pleasure in it. How I wish that I could look into your honest, sunburnt face, lighted up with the glad smile that always greeted me, and I am not ashamed to confess that I long to hear Beelzebub's contented purring, Miro's joyful bark, and the loud whinnying of my poor old Bayard, who never fails to recognize my step. Are they all still alive, the good, faithful, affectionate creatures, and do they seem to remember me? Have you been able to keep yourself and them from starvation thus far? Try to hold out until my return, my good Pierre, so as to share my fate, be it bright or dark, happy or sad, that we may finish our days together in the place where we have suffered so much, yet which is so dear to us all. If I am to be the last of the de Sigognacs, I can only say, the will of God be done. There is still a vacant place left for me in the vault where my forefathers lie. Baron de Sigognac. The Baron sealed this letter with the ring bearing his family arms, which was the only jewel remaining in his possession, directed it and put it into his portfolio to wait until he should find an opportunity to forward it to Gascony. Although by this time it was very late, he could still hear the vague roar of the great city, which, like the sound of the ocean, never entirely ceases. It was so strange and novel to him, in contrast with the profound silence of the country that he had been accustomed to all his life long. As he sat listening to it, he thought he heard cautious footsteps in the corridor, and, extinguishing his light, softly opened his door just a very little way, scarcely more than a crack, and caught a glimpse of a man enveloped in a large cloak, stealing along slowly in the direction the other one had taken. He listened breathlessly until he heard him reach, and quietly enter, apparently the same door. A few minutes later, while he was still on the lookout, another one came creeping stealthily by, making futile efforts to stifle the noise of his creaking boots. His suspicions now thoroughly aroused, de Sigognac continued his watch, and in about half an hour came yet another, a fierce, villainous-looking fellow, and fully armed, as every one of his predecessors had been also. This strange proceeding seemed very extraordinary and menacing to the Baron, and the number of the men, four, brought to his mind the night attack upon him in the streets of Poitiers, after his quarrel with the Duke of Valombreuse. This recollection was like a ray of light, and it instantly flashed upon him that the man he had seen in the kitchen was no other than one of those precious rascals, who had been routed so ignominiously, and these, without doubt, were his comrades. But how came they there? In the very house with him, not by chance, surely. They must have followed him up to Paris, stage by stage, in disguise, or else keeping studiously out of his sight. Evidently the young Duke's animosity was still active, as well as his passion, and he had not renounced his designs upon either Isabel or himself. Our hero was very brave by nature, and did not feel the least anxiety about his own safety, trusting to his good sword to defend himself against his enemies. But he was very uneasy in regard to his sweet Isabel, and dreaded inexpressibly what might be attempted to gain possession of her. Not knowing which one of them the four desperadoes had in view now, he determined not to relax his vigilance an instant, and to take such precautions as he felt pretty sure would circumvent their plans, whatever they might be. He lighted all the candles there were in his room, a goodly number, and opened his door, so that they threw a flood of light on that of Isabel's chamber, which was exactly opposite his own. Next he drew his sword, laid it, with his dagger, on a table he had drawn out in front of the door, and then sat down beside it, facing the corridor, to watch. He waited some time without hearing or seeing anything. 2 o'clock had rung out from a neighbouring church tower when a slight rustling caught his listening ear, and presently one of the four rascals, the very man he had first seen, emerged from the shadow into the bright light streaming out into the passage from his open door. The Baron had sprung to his feet at the first sound, and stood erect on the threshold, sword in hand, with such a lofty, heroic and triumphant air that Mirandol, for it was he, passed quickly by without offering to molest him, with a most deprecating, crestfallen expression, a laughable contrast to his habitual fierce insolence. His three doughty comrades followed in quick succession, but not one of them dared to attack de Sigognac, and they slunk out of sight as rapidly as possible. He saluted each one with a mocking gesture as he passed, and stood tranquilly watching them as long as he could see them. In a few minutes he had the satisfaction of hearing the stamping of horses' feet in the courtyard below, then the opening of the outer door to let them pass out into the street, and finally a great clattering of hoofs as they galloped off down the Rue Dauphine. At breakfast the next morning the tyrant said to de Sigognac, "Captain, doesn't your curiosity prompt you to go out and look about you a little in this great city, one of the finest in the world and of such high renown in history? If it is agreeable to you, I will be your guide and pilot, for I have been familiar from my youth up with the rocks and reefs, the straits and shallows, the scillas and charybdises of this seething ocean, which are often so dangerous, sometimes so fatal, to strangers, and more especially to inexperienced country people. I will be your palinurus, but I promise you that I shall not allow myself to be caught napping, and so fall overboard, like him that Virgil tells us about. We are admirably located here for sightseeing. The Pont Neuf, which is close at hand, you know, is to Paris what the Sacra Via was to ancient Rome, the great resort and rallying place of high and low, great and small, noblemen, gentlemen, bourgeois, working men, rogues and vagabonds. Men of every rank and profession under the sun are to be found gathered together at this general rendezvous. Your kind proposition pleases me greatly, my good Hérode," de Sigognac replied, "and I accept it with thanks. But be sure to tell Scapin that he must remain here and keep a sharp watch over all who come and go, and above all that he must not let any one gain access to Isabelle. The Duke of Vallombreuse has not given up his designs against her and me. I feel very anxious about her safety." And therewith he recounted the occurrences of the preceding night. "I don't believe they would dare to attempt anything in broad daylight," said the tyrant. "Still, it is best to err on the safe side, and we will leave Scapin, Blasius, and Leander to keep guard over Isabelle while we are out. And by the way, I will take my sword with me too, so that I can be of some assistance in case they should find an opportunity to fall upon you in the streets." After having made every arrangement for Isabelle's safety, de Sigognac and his companion sallied forth into the Rue Dauphine and turned towards the Pont Neuf. It was quickly reached, and when they had taken a few steps upon it, a magnificent view suddenly burst upon them, which held the young baron enthralled. In the immediate foreground, on the bridge itself, which was not encumbered with a double row of houses like the Pont au Change and the Pont Saint-Michel, was the fine equestrian statue of that great and good king, Henri Quatre, rivalling in its calm majesty the famous one of Marcus Aurelius on the Capitoline Hill at Rome. A high railing, richly gilded, protected its pedestal from injury by mischievous street Arabs, and the deep, strong tints of the bronze horse and rider stood out vigorously against the appropriate background formed by the distant hillsides beyond the Pont Rouge. On the left bank of the river the spire of the venerable old church of Saint-Germain-des-Prés pointed upwards from amid the houses that completely hemmed it in, and the lofty roof of the unfinished Hôtel de Nevers towered conspicuously above all its surroundings. A little farther on was the only tower still standing of the famous and infamous Hôtel de Nesle, its base bathed by the river, and though it was in a ruinous condition it still lifted itself up proudly above the adjacent buildings. Beyond it lay the marshy Grenouillère, and in the blue, hazy distance could be distinguished the three crosses on the heights of Calvary, or Mont Valérien. The palace of the Louvre occupied the other bank right royally, lighted up by the brilliant winter sunshine, which brought out finely all the marvellous details of its rich and elaborate ornamentation. The long gallery connecting it with the Tuileries, which enabled the monarch to pass freely from his city palace to his country house, especially challenged their admiration, with its magnificent sculptures, its historical bas-reliefs and ornamented cornices, its fretted stonework, fine columns and pilasters. It rivalled the renowned triumphs of the best Greek and Roman architects. Beyond the gardens of the Tuileries, where the city ended, stood the Porte de la Conférence, and along the river bank, outside of it, were the trees of Cour la Reine, the favourite promenade of the fashionable world, which was thronged of an afternoon with gay and luxurious equipages. The two banks, which we have thus hastily sketched, framed in the most animated scene imaginable, the river being covered with boats of all sorts and descriptions, coming and going, crossing and recrossing, while at the quay beside the Louvre lay the royal barges, rich with carving and gilding, and gay with bright-coloured awnings, and near at hand rose the historic towers of Saint-Germain-l'Auxerrois. After gazing silently for a long time at this splendid view, de Sigognac turned away reluctantly at his companion's instance, and joined the little crowd already gathered round the Samaritan, waiting to see the bronze figure surmounting the odd little hydraulic edifice strike the hour with his hammer on the bell of the clock. Meanwhile they examined the gilt bronze statue of Christ, standing beside the Samaritan who was leaning on the curb of the well, the astronomic dial with its zodiac, the grotesque stone mask pouring out the water drawn up from the river below, the stout figure of Hercules supporting the whole thing, and the hollow statue, perched on the topmost pinnacle, that served as a weathercock, like the fortune on the Dogana at Venice and the Giralda at Seville. As the hands on the clock face at last pointed to 10 and 12 respectively, the little chime of bells struck up a merry tune, while the bronze man with the hammer raised his ponderous arm and deliberately struck 10 mighty blows, to the great delight of the spectators. This curious and ingenious piece of mechanism, which had been cunningly devised by one Lintlayer, a Fleming, highly amused and interested de Sigognac, to whom everything of the kind was absolutely new and surprising. "Now," said Hérode, "we will glance at the view from the other side of the bridge, though it is not so magnificent as the one you have already seen, and is very much shut in by the buildings on the Pont au Change yonder. However, there is the Tower of Saint-Jacques, the Spire of Saint-Médéric, and others too numerous to mention. And that is the Sainte-Chapelle, a marvel of beauty, so celebrated, you know, for its treasures and relics. All the houses in that direction are new and handsome, as you see. When I was a boy I used to play at hopscotch where they now stand. Thanks to the munificence of our kings, Paris is being constantly improved and beautified, to the great admiration and delight of everybody, more especially of foreigners, who take home wondrous tales of its splendour." "But what astonishes me," said de Sigognac, "more even than the grandeur and sumptuousness of the buildings, both public and private, is the infinite number of people swarming everywhere, in the streets and open squares and on the bridges, like ants when one has broken into an anthill. They are all rushing distractedly about, up and down, back and forth, as if life and death depended on their speed. How strange it is to think that every individual in this immense crowd must be lodged and fed, and what a prodigious amount of food and wine it must take to satisfy them all." And indeed it was not surprising that the great numbers of people moving in every direction should strike one unaccustomed to the crowded thoroughfares of large cities as extraordinary. On the Pont Neuf an unceasing stream of vehicles rolled in each direction. Fine carriages, richly decorated and gilded, drawn by 2 or 4 prancing horses, with lackeys in brilliant liveries clinging on behind, and stately coachmen on the box. Less pretentious carriages with more quiet steeds and fewer servants. Heavy carts laden with stone, wood, or wine barrels, whose drivers swore loudly at the detentions they were frequently obliged to submit to, and which were unavoidable in such a crush of vehicles. And among them all gentlemen on horseback, threading their way carefully in and out among the press of carts and carriages, and endeavouring to avoid coming in contact with their muddy wheels, not always successfully, while here and there a sedan chair crept slowly along, keeping upon the edge of the stream so as not to be crushed, and the narrow raised walk on either side was thronged with pedestrians. Presently a drove of cattle made its appearance on the bridge, and then the uproar and confusion became terrible indeed. Horses as well as foot passengers were frightened and tried to run away from danger, requiring all the strength of their drivers to restrain them. Soon after that excitement was over, a detachment of soldiers came marching along, with drums beating and colours flying, and everybody had to make way for the valiant sons of Mars, no matter at what inconvenience to themselves. And so it went on, one thing after another, a constant scene of bustle, hurry, and commotion. As de Sigognac and the tyrant strolled slowly along, they were beset by beggars, more or less impudent and pertinacious, and by all sorts of odd characters, plying various extraordinary vocations for the amusement of the passers-by, for which they seemed to be liberally enough remunerated. Here was an improvisatore, singing, not unmelodiously, his rather clever verses. There a blind man, led by a stout, jolly-looking old woman, who recited his dolorous history in a whining voice, and appealed to the charity of the ever-changing multitude. Farther on a charlatan, loudly claiming to be able to cure all the ills that flesh is heir to, by his magical compound, and finding plenty of dupes. And next to him a man with a monkey, whose funny tricks caused much merriment. Suddenly a great tumult arose near the other end of the bridge, and in a moment a compact crowd had gathered around 4 men, who, with loud cries and imprecations, were fighting with swords, apparently with great fury, though in reality it was only a mock combat, probably intended to give a good chance to the thieves and pickpockets in the throng with whom they were in league, such tactics being very common as well as successful. By Hérode's advice, de Sigognac refrained from mingling with the crowd immediately around the combatants, so he could not get a very good view of them, but he was almost sure that they were the very men he had met first in the streets of Poitiers, to their great discomfiture, and had seen again the previous night at the hotel in the Rue Dauphine, where they certainly had gained no advantage to make up for their former defeat. He communicated his suspicions to the tyrant, but the rascals had already slipped away, and it would have been as useless an attempt to find them in the throng as to look for a needle in a haystack. "It certainly is possible," said Hérode thoughtfully, "that this quarrel was gotten up with a view to involving you in it, by some means or other, for we are undoubtedly followed and watched by the emissaries of the Duke of Valambreuse. One of the scoundrels might have made believe that you were in the way, or that you had struck him, and falling upon you suddenly before you had time to draw your sword, have given you a thrust that would have done for you. And if he failed to wound you mortally, the others could have pretended to come to their comrade's aid and have completed the job. Nothing would have been easier. Then they would have separated and slipped away through the crowd before anyone could interfere with them, or else have stood their ground and declared unanimously that they had been obliged to attack you in self-defence. It is next to impossible in such cases to prove that the act was premeditated, and there is no redress for the unhappy victim of such a conspiracy." "But I am loath to believe," said the brave, generous young baron, "that any gentleman would be capable of such an utterly base and unworthy act as this. What, send a set of hired ruffians to foully assassinate his rival? If he is not satisfied with the result of our first encounter, I am willing and ready to cross swords with him again and again, until one or the other of us is slain. That is the way that such matters are arranged among men of honour, my good Hérode." "Doubtless," replied the tyrant, dryly, "but the Duke well knows, despite his cursed pride, that the result of another meeting with you could not but be disastrous to himself. He has tried the strength of your blade, and learned by bitter experience that its point is sharp. You may be sure that he hates you like the very devil, and will not scruple to make use of any means whatever to revenge himself for his defeat at your hands." "Well, if he does not care to try my sword again, we could fight on horseback with pistols. He could not accuse me of having any advantage of him there." Talking thus, the two had reached the Quai de l'École, and there a carriage just missed running over de Sigognac, though he did his best to get out of its way. As it was, only his extremely slender figure saved him from being crushed between it and the wall, so close did it come to him, notwithstanding the fact that there was plenty of room on the other side, and that the coachman could easily have avoided the foot passenger he actually seemed to pursue. The windows of the carriage were all closed and the curtains drawn down, so that it was impossible to tell whether it had any inmates or not, but if de Sigognac could have peeped within he would have seen, reclining languidly upon the luxurious cushions, a handsome young nobleman, richly dressed, whose right arm was supported by a black silk scarf, arranged as a sling. In spite of the warm red glow from the crimson silk curtains, he was very pale, and though so remarkably handsome, his face wore such an expression of hatred and cruelty that he would have inspired dislike rather than admiration, as he sat there with a fierce frown contracting his brow and savagely gnawing his underlip with his gleaming white teeth. In fine, the occupant of the carriage that had so nearly run over the Baron de Sigognac was no other than the young Duke of Valambreuse. "Another failure," said he to himself with an oath, as he rolled along the broad quay past the Tuileries. "And yet I promised that stupid rascal of a coachman of mine 25 louis if he could be adroit enough to run afoul of that confounded de Sigognac, who is the bane of my life, and drive over him as if by accident. Decidedly the star of my destiny is not in the ascendant. This miserable little rustic lordling gets the better of me in everything. Isabel, sweet Isabel, adores him and detests me. He has beaten my lackeys and dared to wound me. But there shall be an end of this sort of thing, and that speedily. Even though he be invulnerable and bear a charmed life, he must and shall be put out of my way. I swear it, though I should be forced to risk my name and my title to compass it." "Humph," said Hérode, drawing a long breath, "why, those brutes must be of the same breed as the famous horses of that Diomedes, king of Thrace, we read of, that pursued men to tear them asunder and fed upon their flesh. But at least you are not hurt, my lord, I trust. That coachman saw you perfectly well, and I would be willing to wager all I possess in the world that he purposely tried to run over you. He deliberately turned his horses towards you. I am sure of it, for I saw the whole thing. Did you observe whether there was a coat of arms on the panel? As you are a nobleman yourself, I suppose you must be familiar with the devices of the leading families in France." "Yes, I am, of course," answered de Sigognac, "but I was too much occupied in getting out of the way of the swift-rolling carriage to notice whether there was anything of that kind on it or not." "That's a pity," rejoined the tyrant regretfully, "for if we only knew that, we should have a clue that might lead to our discovering the truth about this most suspicious affair. It is only too evident that someone is trying to put you out of the way, quibuscumque viis, as the pedant would say. Although we unfortunately have no proof of it, I am very much inclined to think that this same carriage belongs to his lordship the Duke of Vallombreuse, who wished to indulge himself in the pleasure of driving over the body of his enemy in his chariot, in true classical and imperial style. "What extraordinary idea have you got into your head now, Sir Hérod?" said de Sigognac, rather indignantly. "Come, that would be too infamous and villainous a proceeding for any gentleman to be guilty of, and you must remember that, after all, the Duke of Vallombreuse is one, and that he belongs to a very high and noble family. Besides, did not we leave him in Poitiers laid up with his wound? How then could he possibly be in Paris, when we have only just arrived here ourselves?" "But didn't we stop several days at Tours, and again at Orléans? And even if his wound were not entirely healed, he could easily travel in his luxurious carriage, by easy stages, from Poitiers to Paris. His hurt was not of a dangerous character, you know, and he is young and vigorous. You must be on your guard, my dear captain, unceasingly. Never relax your vigilance for one moment, for I tell you there are those about who seek your life. You once out of the way, Isabel would be in the Duke's power, for what could we, poor players, do against such a great and powerful nobleman? Even if Vallombreuse himself be not in Paris, though I am almost positive that he is, his emissaries are, as you know, and but for your own courage and watchfulness you would have been assassinated in your bed by them last night." This de Sigognac could not dispute, and he only nodded in token of assent, as he grasped the hilt of his sword, so as to be ready to draw it at the slightest cause for suspicion or alarm. Meantime they had walked on as far as the Porte de la Conférence, and now saw ahead of them a great cloud of dust, and through it the glitter of bayonets. They stepped aside to let the cavalcade pass, and saw that the soldiers preceded the carriage of the king, who was returning from Saint-Germain to the Louvre. The curtains of the royal vehicle were raised, and the glasses let down, so that the people could distinctly see their sovereign, Louis XIII, who, pale as a ghost and dressed all in black, sat as motionless as an effigy in wax. Long dark brown hair fell about his mournful, ghastly countenance, upon which was depicted the same terrible ennui that drove Philip II of Spain to seclude himself so much, during the later years of his life, in the silence and solitude of the dreary Escorial. His eyes were fixed on vacancy, and seemed utterly lifeless. No desire, no thought, no will lent them light or expression. A profound disgust for and weariness of everything in this life had relaxed his lower lip, which fell sullenly, in a morose, pouting way. His hands, excessively thin and white, lay listlessly upon his knees, like those of certain Egyptian idols. And yet, for all, there was a truly royal majesty about this mournful figure, which personified France, and in whose veins flowed sluggishly the generous blood of Henri IV. The young baron had always thought of the king as a sort of supernatural being, exalted above all other men, glorious and majestic in his person, and resplendent in sumptuous raiment, enriched with gold and precious stones. And now he saw only this sad, motionless figure clad in dismal black, and apparently unconscious of his surroundings, sunk in a profound reverie that none would dare to intrude upon. He had dreamed of a gracious, smiling sovereign, showering good gifts upon his loyal subjects, and here was an apathetic, inanimate being who seemed capable of no thought for any one but himself. He was sadly disappointed, shocked, amazed, and he felt with a sinking heart how hopeless was his own case. For even should he be able to approach this mournful, listless monarch, what sympathy could be expected from him? The future looked darker than ever now to this brave young heart. Absorbed in these sorrowful reflections, he walked silently along beside his companion, who suspected his taciturn mood, and did not intrude upon it until, as the hour of noon approached, he suggested that they should turn their steps homeward, so as to be in time for the midday meal. When they reached the hotel, they were relieved to find that nothing particular had happened during their absence. Isabel, quietly seated at table with the others when they entered, received the baron with her usual sweet smile, and held out her little white hand to him. The comedians asked many questions about his first experiences in Paris, and inquired mischievously whether he had brought his cloak, his purse, and his handkerchief home with him, to which de Sigognac joyfully answered in the affirmative. In this friendly banter he soon forgot his sombre thoughts, and asked himself whether he had not been the dupe of a hypochondriac fancy, which could see nothing anywhere but plots and conspiracies. He had not been alarmed without reason, however, for his enemies, vexed but not discouraged by the failure of their several attempts upon him, had by no means renounced their determination to make way with him. Mirandol, who was threatened by the Duke with being sent back to the galleys whence he had rescued him, unless he and his comrades succeeded in disposing of the Baron de Sigagnac, resolved to invoke the assistance of a certain clever rascal of his acquaintance, who had never been known to fail in any job of that kind which he undertook. He no longer felt himself capable to cope with the Baron, and moreover now laboured under the serious disadvantage of being personally known to him. He went accordingly to look up his friend, Jacquintin Lamporde by name, who lodged not very far from the Pont Neuf, and was lucky enough to find him at home, sleeping off the effects of his last carouse. He awoke him with some difficulty, and was violently abused for his pains. Then, having quietly waited until his friend's first fury was exhausted, he announced that he had come to consult with him on important business, having an excellent job to entrust to him, and begging that he would be good enough to listen to what he had to say. "I never listen to anybody when I am drunk," said Jacquemin Lamporde, majestically putting his elbow on his knee as he spoke, and resting his head on his hand. "And besides, I have plenty of money, any quantity of gold pieces. We plundered a rich English lord last night, who was a walking cash-box, and I am a gentleman of wealth just at present. However, one evening at Lansquenet may swallow it all up. I can't resist gambling, you know, and I am deuced unlucky at it, so I will see you tonight about this little matter of yours. Meet me at the foot of the bronze statue on the Pont Neuf at midnight. I shall be as fresh and bright as a lark by that time, and ready for anything. You shall give me your instructions then, and we will agree upon my share of the spoils. It should be something handsome, for I have the vanity to believe that no one would come and disturb a fellow of my calibre for any insignificant piece of business. But after all, I am weary of playing the thief and pickpocket. It is beneath me, and I mean to devote all my energies in future to the noble art of assassination. It is more worthy of my undisputed prowess. I would rather be a grand man-slaying lion than any meaner beast of prey. If this is a question of killing, I am your man. But one thing more, it must be a fellow who will defend himself. Our victims are so apt to be cowardly and give in without a struggle, it is no better than sticking a pig. And that I cannot stand, it disgusts me. A good manly resistance, the more stubborn the better, gives a pleasant zest to the task. You may rest easy on that score, Mirandol replied, with a malicious smile. You will find a tough customer to handle, I promise you. So much the better, said Lamporde, for it is a long time since I have found an adversary worth crossing swords with. But enough of this for the present. Good-bye to you, and let me finish my nap. But he tried in vain to compose himself to sleep again, and after several fruitless efforts gave it up as a bad job, then began to shake a companion who had slept soundly on the floor under the table during the preceding discussion, and when he had succeeded in rousing him, both went off to a gaming-house, where Lansquenet was in active progress. The company was composed of thieves, cutthroats, professional bullies, ruffians of every sort, lackeys and low-fellows of various callings, and a few well-to-do unsophisticated bourgeois who had been enticed in there, unfortunate pigeons destined to be thoroughly plucked. Lamporde, who played recklessly, had soon lost all his boasted wealth, and was left with empty pockets. He took his bad luck with the utmost philosophy. "Oof!" said he to his companion when they had gone out into the street, and the cool night air blew refreshingly upon his heated face. "Here I am, rid of my money, and a free man again. It is strange that it should always make such a brute of me. It surprises me no longer that rich men should invariably be such stupid fools. Now that I haven't a penny left, I feel as gay as a lark, ready for anything. Brilliant ideas buzz about my brain, like bees around the hive. Lamporde's himself again. But there's the Samaritan striking 12, and a friend of mine must be waiting for me down by the Bronze Henri Quatre. So good night." He quitted his companion and walked quickly to the rendezvous, where he found Mirandol diligently studying his own shadow in the moonlight, and the two ruffians, after looking carefully about them to make sure that there was no one within earshot, held a long consultation in very low tones. What they said we do not know, but when Lamporde quitted the agent of the Duke of Valambreuse, he joyously jingled the handful of gold pieces in his pocket, with an imprudent audacity that showed conclusively how much he was respected by the thieves and cutthroats who haunted the Pont Neuf. End of section 12. Section 13 of Captain Fracas by Théophile Gautier. translated by Frederick de Sumicrast. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Chapter 12. The Crowned Radish. Jacquemin Lampourde, after parting company with Mirandol, seemed in great uncertainty as to which way he should go, and had not yet decided when he reached the end of the Pont Neuf. He was like the donkey between two bundles of hay, or, if that comparison be not pleasing, like a piece of iron between two magnets of equal power. On the one side was Lansquenet, with the fascinating excitement of rapidly winning and losing the broad gold pieces that he loved, and on the other the tavern, with its tempting array of bottles, for he was a drunkard as well as a gambler, this same notorious Jacquemin Lampourde. He stood stock still for a while, debating this knotty point with himself, quite unable to come to a decision, and growing very much vexed at his own hesitation, when suddenly a brilliant idea occurred to him, and plunging his hand into his well-filled pocket, he drew forth a gold piece, which he tossed into the air, crying, "Head for the tavern, tail for Lansquenet." The coin rang upon the pavement as it fell, and he kneeled down to see what fate had decided for him. Head was up. "Very well," said he philosophically, as he picked up the piece of money, carefully wiped off the mud, and put it back in his pocket. "I'll go and get drunk." Then with long strides he made off to his favourite tavern, which had the advantage of being in the immediate vicinity of his own lodgings, so that with a few zigzags he was at home, after he had filled himself with wine from the soles of his boots to the apple in his throat. It was not an inviting-looking place, this same tavern, with the odd device of an enormous radish, bearing a golden crown, now rather tarnished, which had served as its sign for many generations of wine-drinkers. The heavy wooden shutters were all closed when Lampourde reached it, but by the bright light streaming through their crevices, and the sounds of song and revelry that reached his ear, he knew that there must be a numerous company within. Knocking on the door in a peculiar way with the handle of his sword, he made himself known as an habitué of the house, and was promptly admitted, the door being carefully made fast again the moment he had entered. The large low room into which he made his way was filled with the smoke from many pipes, and redolent with the fumes of wine. A cheerful wood fire was blazing on the hearth, lighting up the array of bottles in the bar, which was placed near it, where the master of the establishment sat enthroned, keeping a watchful eye on the noisy crowd gathered round the many small tables with which the room abounded, drinking, smoking, playing at various games, and singing ribald songs. Lampourde paid no attention to the uproarious throng, further than to look about and make sure that none of his own particular friends and associates were among them. He found an unoccupied table, to which a servant quickly brought a bottle of fine old Canary wine, very choice and rare, which was reserved for a few privileged and appreciative customers, who could afford to indulge in such luxuries. Although he was quite by himself, two glasses were placed before him, as his dislike to drinking alone was well known, and at any moment a comrade might come in and join him. Meantime he slowly filled his own glass, raised it to the level of his eyes, and looked long and lovingly through the beautiful clear topaz of the generous wine. Having thus satisfied the sense of sight, he passed to that of smell, and held the glass under his nostrils, where he could enjoy the delicious aroma arising from it, giving the wine a rotary motion as he did so, in a very artistic manner. Then, putting the glass to his lips, he let a few drops trickle slowly down over his tongue to his palate, lengthening out the enjoyment as much as possible, and giving an approving smack of relish as he at last swallowed the smooth nectar. Thus Maître Jacquemin Lampourde managed to gratify three of the five senses man is blessed with by means of a single glass of wine. He pretended that the other two might also have a share of the enjoyment, that of touch by the highly polished surface and swelling curves of the wine-glass, and that of hearing by the merry ringing when two glasses are clinked together, or by the musical sounds to be brought forth from a glass by drawing a moistened finger round and round the edge of it. But these are fantastic and paradoxical ideas, which only serve to show the vicious refinement of this fastidious ruffian. He had been but a few minutes alone when an odd-looking, shabbily dressed individual came in, who rejoiced in a remarkably pale face, which looked as if it had been chalked, and a nose as red and fiery as a live coal. The idea of how many casks of wine and bottles of brandy must have been imbibed, to bring it to such an intensity of erubescence, would be enough to terrify the ordinary drinker. This singular countenance was like a cheese, with a bright red cherry stuck in the middle of it, and to finish the portrait it would only be necessary to add two apple seeds, placed a little obliquely, for the eyes, and a wide gash for a mouth. Such was Malartic, the intimate friend, the Pylades, the Euryalus, the Phidas Achates of Jacquemin Lampourde, who certainly was not handsome, but his mental and moral qualities made up for his little physical disadvantages. Next to Lampourde, for whom he professed the most exalted admiration and respect, he was accounted the most skilful swordsman in Paris. He was always lucky at cards, and could drink to any extent without becoming intoxicated. For the rest, he was a man of great delicacy and honour, in his way, ready to run any risk to help or support a friend, and capable of enduring any amount of torture rather than betray his comrades, so that he enjoyed the universal and unbounded esteem of his circle. Malartic went straight to Lampourde's table, sat down opposite to him, silently seized the glass the other had promptly filled, and drained it at a single draught. Evidently his method differed from his friend's, but that it was equally efficacious his nose bore indisputable witness. The two men drank steadily and in silence until they had emptied their third bottle, and then called for pipes. When they had puffed away for a while and enveloped themselves in a dense cloud of smoke, they fell into conversation, deploring the bad times since the king, his court and followers, had all gone to Saint-Germain, and comparing notes as to their own individual doings since their last meeting. Thus far they had paid no attention whatever to the company round them, but now such a loud discussion arose over the conditions of a bet between two men about some feat that one of them declared he could perform and the other pronounced impossible, that they both looked round to see what it was all about. A man of lithe, vigorous frame, with a complexion dark as a Moor's, jet-black hair and flashing eyes, was drawing out of his red girdle a large, dangerous-looking knife, which, when opened, was nearly as long as a sword, and called in Valencia, where it was made, a Navaja. He carefully examined and tested the edge and point of this formidable weapon, with which he seemed satisfied, said to the man he had been disputing with, "I am ready," then turned and called, "Chiquita! Chiquita!" At the sound of her name a little girl who had been sleeping rolled up in a cloak on the floor in a dark corner, rose and came towards Agostino, for it was he, of course, and fixing her large dark eyes upon his face earnestly, said, "Master, what do you want me to do? I am ready to obey you here as everywhere else, because you are so brave, and have so many red marks on your Navaja." Chiquita said this rapidly, in a patois which was as unintelligible to the Frenchmen around her as German, Hebrew, or Chinese. Agostino took her by the hand and placed her with her back against the door, telling her to keep perfectly still, and the child, accustomed to that sort of thing, showed neither alarm nor surprise, but stood quietly, looking straight before her with perfect serenity, while Agostino, at the other end of the room, standing with one foot advanced, balanced the dread Navaja in his hand. Suddenly, with a quick jerking movement, he sent it flying through the air, and it struck into the wooden door just over Chiquita's head. As it darted by, like a flash of lightning, the spectators had involuntarily closed their eyes for a second, but the fragile child's long dark eyelashes did not even quiver. The brigand's wonderful skill elicited a loud burst of admiration and applause from an audience not easily surprised or pleased, in which even the man who had lost his wager joined enthusiastically. Agostino went and drew out the knife, which was still vibrating, and returning to his place this time sent it in between Chiquita's arm, which was hanging down by her side, and her body. If it had deviated a hair's breadth, it must have wounded her. At this everybody cried enough, but Agostino insisted upon aiming at the other side as well, so as to prove to them that there was no chance about it, that it was purely a matter of skill. Again the terrible Navaja flew through the air, and went straight to the mark, and Chiquita, very much delighted at the applause that followed, looked about her proudly, glorying in Agostino's triumph. She still wore Isabel's pearl beads round her slender brown neck, in other respects was much better dressed than when we first saw her, and even had shoes on her tiny feet. They seemed to worry and annoy her very much, it is true, but she found them a necessary nuisance on the cold Paris pavements, and so had to submit to wearing them with as good a grace as she could muster. When Agostino gave her leave to quit her position, she quietly returned to her corner, rolled herself up anew in the large cloak, and fell sound asleep again, while he, after pocketing the 5 pistoles he had won, sat down to finish his measure of cheap wine, which he did very slowly, intending to remain where he was as long as possible. He had no lodging-place yet in Paris, having arrived that very evening, and this warm room was far more comfortable than a refuge in some convent porch, or under the arch of a bridge, perhaps, where he had feared that he and Chiquita might have to lie shivering all night long. Quiet being restored, comparatively speaking, Lampourde and Malartic resumed their interrupted conversation, and after a few remarks upon the strange performance they had just witnessed, in which Lampourde especially praised Agostino's marvellous skill, and Malartic warmly commended Chiquita's wonderful courage and sang-froid. The former confided to his friend that he had a piece of work in prospect, in which he would need some assistance, and desired to have his opinion as to which of their comrades would be best suited for his purpose. He told him that in the first place he was commissioned to dispatch a certain Captain Fracas, an actor, who had dared to interfere with the love affair of a very great lord. In this, of course, he would not require any aid, but he had also to make arrangements for the abduction of the lady, a very beautiful young actress, who was beloved by both the nobleman and the comedian, and who would be zealously defended by the members of the dramatic company to which she belonged, so that he should be obliged to resort to some stratagem, and would probably need the help of several hands to carry it out, adding that they were sure of being well paid, for the young lord was as generous and open-handed as he was wealthy and determined. Thereupon they fell to discussing the respective merits of their numerous friends and acquaintances, gentlemen of the same stamp as themselves, and having decided upon four, and determined to keep an eye upon Agostino, who seemed a clever rascal and might be of use, they called for another bottle of wine. When that was finished, Jacquemin Lamport was indisputably drunk, and having loyally kept his word, retired, somewhat unsteadily, to his own quarters in a high state of maudlin satisfaction, accompanied by his friend Malartique, whom he had invited to spend the night with him. By this time, it was nearly 4 o'clock in the morning, the Crowned Radish was almost deserted, and the master of the establishment, seeing that there was no prospect of further custom, told his servants to rouse up and turn out all the sleepers, Agostino and Chiquita among the rest, and his orders were promptly executed. End of section 13. Section 14 of Captain Fracas by Théophile Gautier, translated by Frederick de Sumicrast. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Chapter 13. A Double Attack. The Duke of Vallombreuse was not a man to neglect his love affairs any more than his enemies. If he hated de Sigognac mortally, he felt for Isabelle that furious passion which the unattainable is apt to excite in a haughty and violent nature like his, that has never met with resistance. To get possession of the young actress had become the ruling thought of his life. Spoiled by the easy victories he had always gained heretofore in his career of gallantry, his failure in this instance was utterly incomprehensible to him, as well as astonishing and maddening. He could not understand it. Oftentimes in the midst of a conversation, at the theatre, at church, at the court, anywhere and everywhere, the thought of it would suddenly rush into his mind, sweeping everything before it, overwhelming him afresh with wonder and amazement. And indeed it could not be easy for a man who did not believe that such an anomaly as a truly virtuous woman ever existed, much less a virtuous actress, to understand Isabelle's firm resistance to the suit of such a rich and handsome young nobleman as himself. He sometimes wondered whether it could be that after all she was only playing a part, and holding back for a while so as to obtain more from him in the end, tactics that he knew were not unusual. But the indignant, peremptory way in which she had rejected the casket of jewels proved conclusively that no such base motives actuated Isabelle. All his letters she had returned unopened, all his advances she had persistently repulsed, and he was at his wit's end to know what to do next. Finally he concluded to send for old Madame Léonard to come and talk the matter over with him. He had kept up secret relations with her, as it is always well to have a spy in the enemy's camp. The Duke received her, when she came in obedience to his summons, in his own particular and favoured room, to which she was conducted by a private staircase. It was a most dainty and luxurious apartment, fitted up with exquisite taste, and hung round with portraits of beautiful women, admirably painted by Simon Vouet, a celebrated master of that day, representing different mythological characters and set in richly carved oval frames. These were all likenesses of the young Duke's various mistresses, each one displaying her own peculiar charms to the greatest possible advantage, and having consented to sit for her portrait, in a costume and character chosen by the Duke, as a special favour, without the most remote idea that it was to form part of a gallery. When the duenna had entered and made her best curtsy, the Duke condescendingly signed to her to be seated, and immediately began to question her eagerly about Isabelle, as to whether there were any signs yet of her yielding to his suit, and also how matters were progressing between her and the detested Captain Fracas. Although the crafty old woman endeavoured to put the best face upon everything, and was very diplomatic in her answers to these searching questions, the information that she had to give was excessively displeasing to the imperious young nobleman, who had much ado to control his temper sufficiently to continue the conversation. Before he let her go, he begged her to suggest some plan by which he could hope to soften the obdurate beauty, appealing to her great experience in such intrigues, and offering to give her any reward she chose to claim if she would but help him to succeed. She had nothing better to propose, however, than secretly administering a strong narcotic to Isabelle, and concerting some plan to deliver her into his hands while unconscious from the effects of it, which even the unscrupulous young Duke indignantly rejected. Whereupon, fixing her wicked old eyes admiringly upon his handsome face, and apparently moved by a sudden inspiration, she said, "But why does not your lordship conduct this affair in person? Why not begin a regular and assiduous courtship in the good old style? You are as beautiful as Adonis, my lord Duke. You are young, fascinating, powerful, wealthy, a favourite at court, rich in everything that is pleasing to the weaker sex. And there is not a woman on earth who could long hold out against you, if you would condescend, my lord, to plead your own cause with her." "By Jove, the old woman is right," said Vallombreuse to himself, glancing complacently at the reflection of his own handsome face and figure in a full-length mirror opposite to him. "Isabelle may be virtuous and cold, but she is not blind, and nature has not been so unkind to me that the sight of me should inspire her with horror. I can at least hope to produce the same happy effect as a fine statue or picture, which attracts and charms the eye by its symmetry, or its beautiful and harmonious colouring. Then, kneeling at her feet, I can softly whisper some of those persuasive words that no woman can listen to unmoved, accompanied by such passionately ardent looks that the ice round her heart will melt under them and vanish quite away. Not one of the loftiest, haughtiest ladies at the court has ever been able to withstand them. They have thawed the iciest, most immaculate of them all. And besides, it surely cannot fail to flatter the pride of this disdainful, high-spirited little actress to have a real duke actually and openly kneeling at her feet. Yes, I will take the old woman's advice, and pay my court to her so charmingly and perseveringly that I shall conquer at last. And she will not be able to withstand me, my sweet Isabelle. And it will be a miracle indeed if she has a regret left then for that cursed de Sigognac, who shall no longer interfere between my love and me. That I swear. She will soon forget him in my arms." Having dismissed old Madame Léonard with a handsome gratuity, the Duke next summoned his valet, Picard, and held an important consultation with him as to his most becoming costumes, finally deciding upon a very rich but comparatively plain one, all of black velvet, whose elegant simplicity he thought would be likely to suit Isabelle's fastidious taste better than any more gorgeous array, and in which it must be confessed that he looked adorably handsome, his really beautiful face and fine figure appearing to the utmost advantage. His toilet completed, he sent a peremptory order to his coachman to have the carriage, with the four bays, ready in a quarter of an hour. When Picard had departed on this errand, Vallombreuse began pacing slowly to and fro in his chamber, glancing into the mirror each time he passed it with a self-satisfied smile. "That proud little minx must be deucedly cross-grained and unappreciative," said he, "if she does not perceive how much more worthy I am of her admiration than that shabby de Sigognac. Oh, yes, she'll be sure to come round, in spite of her obstinate affectation of such ferocious virtue, and her tiresome platonic love for her impecunious suitor. Yes, my little beauty, your portrait shall figure in one of those oval frames ere long. I think I'll have you painted as chaste Diana, descended from the sky, despite her coldness, to lavish sweet kisses on Endymion. You shall take your place among those other goddesses, who were as coy and hard to please at first as yourself, and who are far greater ladies, my dear, than you ever will be. Your fall is at hand, and you must learn, as your betters have done before you, that there's no withstanding the will of a Vallombreuse. Frango nec frangor is my motto." A servant entered to announce that the carriage awaited his lordship's pleasure, and during the short drive from his own house to the Rue Dauphine, the young Duke, despite his arrogant assurance, felt his heart beating faster than usual as he wondered how Isabelle would receive him. When the splendid carriage, with its four prancing horses and servants in gorgeous liveries, drove into the courtyard of the hotel where the comedians were stopping, the landlord himself, cap in hand, rushed out to ask the pleasure of the lordly visitor. But rapid as were his movements, the Duke had already alighted before he could reach him. He cut short the obsequious host's obeisances and breathless offers of service by an impatient gesture, and said peremptorily, "Mademoiselle Isabelle is stopping here. I wish to see her. Is she at home? Do not send to announce my visit, only let me have a servant to show me the way to her room." "My lord, let me have the glory of conducting your lordship myself. Such an honour is too great for a rascally servant. I myself am not worthy of so distinguished a privilege." "As you please," said Vallombreuse with haughty negligence, "only be quick about it. There are people at every window already, staring down at me as if I were the Grand Turk in person." He followed his guide, who, with many bows and apologies, preceded him upstairs, and down a long, narrow corridor with doors on either side, like a convent, until they reached Isabelle's room, where the landlord paused, and, bowing lower than ever, asked what name he should have the honour of announcing. "You can go now," the Duke replied, laying his hand on the door. "I will announce myself." Isabelle was sitting by the window, diligently studying her part in a new play to be shortly put in rehearsal, and, at the moment the Duke of Vallombreuse softly entered her chamber, was repeating in a low voice and with closed eyes the verses she was learning by heart, just as a child does its lessons. The light from the window shone full upon her beautiful head and face, seen in profile, and her lovely figure thrown back in a negligent attitude full of grace and abandon. She made a most bewitching picture thus, and with a delicious effect of chiaroscuro that would have enchanted an artist, it enthralled the young Duke. Supposing that the intruder who entered so quietly was only the chambermaid, come to perform some forgotten duty, Isabelle did not interrupt her study or look up, but went on composedly with her recitation. The Duke, who had breathlessly advanced to the centre of the room, paused there, and stood motionless, gazing with rapture upon her beauty. As he waited for her to open her eyes and become aware of his presence, he sank gracefully down upon one knee, holding his hat so that its long plume swept the floor, and laying his hand on his heart, in an attitude that was slightly theatrical perhaps, but as respectful as if he had been kneeling before a queen. Excitement and agitation had flushed his pale cheeks a little. His eyes were luminous and full of fire, a sweet smile hovered on his rich, red lips, and he had never looked more splendidly, irresistibly handsome in his life. At last Isabelle moved, raised her eyelids, turned her head, and perceived the Duke of Vallombreuse kneeling within 6 feet of her. If Perseus had suddenly appeared before her, holding up Medusa's horrid head, the effect would have been much the same. She sat like a statue, motionless, breathless, as if she had been petrified or frozen stiff, her eyes dilated with excessive terror, fixed upon his face, her lips parted, her throat parched and dry, her tongue paralysed, unable to move or speak. A ghastly pallor overspread her horror-stricken countenance, a deathly chill seized upon all her being, and for one dreadful moment of supreme anguish she feared that she was going to faint quite away. But by a desperate, prodigious effort of will, she recalled her failing senses, that she might not leave herself entirely defenceless in the power of her cruel persecutor. "Can it be possible that I inspire such overwhelming horror in your gentle breast, my sweet Isabelle?" said Vallombreuse in his most dulcet tones, and without stirring from his position. "That the mere sight of me produces an effect like this? Why, a wild beast, crouching to spring upon you from his lair, with angry roar and blazing eyeballs, could not terrify you more. My presence here may be a little sudden and startling, I admit, but you must not be too hard upon one who lives only to love and adore you. I knew that I risked your anger when I decided to take this step, but I could not exist any longer without a sight of you, and I humbly crave your pardon if I have offended you by my ardour and devotion. I kneel at your feet, fair lady, a despairing and most unhappy suppliant for your grace and favour." "Rise, my lord, I beseech you," said the frightened, trembling girl, speaking with great difficulty and in a voice that sounded strange in her own ears. "Such a position does not become your rank. I am only an actress, and my poor attractions do not warrant such homage. Forget this fleeting fancy, I pray you, and carry elsewhere the ardour and devotion that are wasted upon me, and that so many great and noble ladies would be proud and happy to receive and reward." "What do I care for other women, be they what they may?" cried Vallombreuse impetuously, as he rose in obedience to her request. "It is your pride and purity that I adore, your beauty and goodness that I worship. Your very cruelty is more charming to me than the utmost favour of any other woman in the world. Your sweet modesty and angelic loveliness have inspired in me a passion that is almost delirium, and unless you can learn to love me I shall die. I cannot live without you. You need not be afraid of me," he added, as Isabelle recoiled when he made one step forward, and tried to open the window with her trembling hands, as if she meant to throw herself out in case of his coming any nearer. "See, I will stay where I am. I will not touch you, not even the hem of your garment, so great is my respect for you, charming Isabelle. I do not ask anything more than that you will deign to suffer my presence here a little longer now, and permit me to pay my court to you, lay siege to your heart, and wait patiently until it surrenders itself to me freely and of its own accord, as it surely will. The most respectful lover could not do more." "Spare me this useless pursuit, my lord," pleaded Isabelle, "and I will reward you with the warmest gratitude. But love you I cannot, now or ever." "'You have neither father, brother, husband, or affianced lover,' persisted Vallombreuse, "'to forbid the advances of a gallant gentleman who seeks only to please and serve you. "'My sincere homage is surely not insulting to you. "'Why do you repulse me so? "'Oh, you do not dream what a splendid prospect would open out before you "'if you would but yield to my entreaties. "'I would surround you with everything that is beautiful and dainty, luxurious and rare. "'I would anticipate your every wish. "'I would devote my whole life to your service.' The story of our love should be more enchanting, more blissful than that of love himself with his delicious psyche. Not even the gods could rival us. Come, Isabel, do not turn so coldly away from me. Do not persevere in this maddening silence, nor drive to desperation and desperate deeds a passion that is capable of anything, of everything, save renouncing its adored object, your own sweet, charming self. But this love, of which any other woman would be justly proud, said Isabel modestly, I cannot return or accept. You must believe me, my lord, for I mean every word I say, and I shall never swerve from this decision, even if the virtue and purity that I value more highly than life itself were not against it. I should still feel myself obliged to decline this dangerous honour. Deign to look upon me with favour and indulgence, my sweet Isabel, continued Vallombreuse, without heeding her words, and I will make you an object of envy to the greatest and noblest ladies in all France. To any other woman I should say, take what you please of my treasures, my chateaux, my estates, my gold, my jewels. Dress your lackeys in liveries richer than the court costumes of princes. Have your horses shod with silver. Live as luxuriously as a queen. Make even Paris wonder at your lavish splendour, if you will, though Paris is not easily roused to wonder. But I well know that you have a soul far above all such sordid temptations as these. They would have no weight with you, my noble Isabel. But there is a glory that may touch you, that of having conquered Vallombreuse, of leading him captive behind your chariot wheels, of commanding him as your servant and your slave. Vallombreuse, who has never yielded before, who has been the commander, not the commanded, and whose proud neck has never yet bowed to wear the fetters that so many fair hands have essayed to fasten round it. Such a captive would be too illustrious for my chains, said Isabel firmly, and as I could never consent to accept so much honour at your hands, my lord, I pray you to desist and relieve me of your presence. Hitherto the Duke of Vallombreuse had managed to keep his temper under control. He had artfully concealed his naturally violent and domineering spirit under a feigned mildness and humility. But at Isabel's determined and continued, though modest and respectful, resistance to his pleading, his anger was rapidly rising to boiling point. He felt that there was love, devoted love, for another behind her persistent rejection of his suit, and his wrath and jealousy augmented each other. Throwing aside all restraint, he advanced towards her impetuously, whereat she made another desperate effort to tear open the casement. A fierce frown contracted his brow, he gnawed his under lip savagely, and his whole face was transformed. If it had been beautiful enough for an angel's before, it was like a demon's now. "'Why don't you tell the truth?' he cried in a loud, angry voice, "'and say that you are madly in love with that precious rascal, de Sigognac.' That is the real reason for all this pretended virtue that you shamelessly flaunt in men's faces. What is there about that cursed scoundrel, I should like to know, that charms you so? Am I not handsomer, of higher rank, younger, richer, as clever, and as much in love with you as he can possibly be? Aye, and more, 10,000 times more. He has at least one quality that you are lacking in, my lord, said Isabel with dignity. He knows how to respect the woman he loves. "'That's only because he cares so little about you, my charmer,' cried Vallombreuse, suddenly seizing Isabel, who vainly strove to escape from him, in his arms, and straining her violently to his breast, despite her frantic struggles and agonized cry for help. As if in response to it, the door was suddenly opened, and the tyrant, making the most deprecating gestures and profound bows, entered the room and advanced towards Isabel, who was at once released by Vallombreuse, with muttered curses at this most inopportune intrusion.' "'I beg your pardon, mademoiselle,' said Hérode, with a furtive glance at the Duke, "'for interrupting you. "'I did not know that you were in such good company, "'but the hour for rehearsal has struck, "'and we are only waiting for you to begin.' "'He had left the door ajar, "'and an apparently waiting group could be discerned without, "'consisting of the pedant, Scapin, Leander, and Zerbine, "'a reassuring and most welcome sight to poor Isabel. For one instant the Duke, in his rage, was tempted to draw his sword, make a furious charge upon the intruding canaille, and disperse them, vie et armis, But a second thought stayed his hand, as he realized that the killing or wounding of two or three of these miserable actors would not further his suit, and besides he could not stain his noble hands with such vile blood as theirs. So he put force upon himself and restrained his rage, and, bowing with icy politeness to Isabelle, who, trembling in every limb, had edged nearer to her friends, he made his way out of the room, turning, however, at the threshold to say with peculiar emphasis, "Au revoir, mademoiselle," a very simple phrase certainly, but replete with significance of a very terrible and threatening nature from the way in which it was spoken. His face was so expressive of evil passions as he said it that Isabelle shuddered, and felt a violent spasm of fear pass over her, even though the presence of her companions guaranteed her against any further attempts at violence just then. She felt the mortal anguish of the fated dove above which the cruel kite is circling swiftly in the air, drawing nearer with every rapid round. The Duke of Vallombreuse regained his carriage, which awaited him in the court, followed by the obsequious landlord, with much superfluous and aggravating ceremony that he would gladly have dispensed with, and the next minute the rumble of wheels indicated to Isabelle that her dangerous visitor had taken his departure. Now to explain the timely interruption that came so opportunely to rescue Isabelle from her enemy's clutches. The arrival of the Duke in his superb carriage at the hotel in the Rue Dauphine had caused an excitement and flutter throughout the whole establishment, which soon reached the ears of the tyrant, who, like Isabelle, was busy learning his new part in the seclusion of his own room. In the absence of de Sigognac, who was detained at the theatre to try on a new costume, the worthy tyrant, knowing the Duke's evil intentions, determined to keep a close watch over his actions, and having summoned the others, applied his ear to the keyhole of Isabelle's door, and listened attentively to all that passed within, holding himself in readiness to interfere at any moment if the Duke should venture to offer violence to the defenceless girl. And to his prudence and courage it was due that she escaped further persecution, on that occasion, from her relentless and unscrupulous tormentor. That day was destined to be an eventful one. It will be remembered that Lampourde, the professional assassin, had received from Mérandol, acting for the Duke of Vallombreuse, a commission to put Captain Fracasse quietly out of the way, and accordingly that worthy was dodging about on the Pont Neuf, at the hour of sunset, waiting to intercept his intended victim, who would necessarily pass that way in returning to his hotel. Jacquemin awaited his arrival impatiently, frequently breathing on his fingers and rubbing them vigorously, so that they should not be quite numb with the cold when the moment for action came, and stamping up and down in order to warm his half-frozen feet. The weather was extremely cold, and the sun had set behind the Pont Rouge, in a heavy mass of blood-red clouds. Twilight was coming on apace, and already there were only occasional foot passengers or vehicles to be encountered hurrying along the deserted streets. At last de Sigognac appeared, walking very fast, for a vague anxiety about Isabelle had taken possession of him, and he was in haste to get back to her. In his hurry and preoccupation he did not notice Lampourde, who suddenly approached and laid hold of his cloak, which he snatched off with a quick, strong jerk that broke its fastenings. Without stopping to dispute the cloak with his assailant, whom he mistook at first for an ordinary footpad, de Sigognac instantly drew his sword and attacked him. Lampourde, on his side, was ready for him, and, pleased with the baron's way of handling his weapon, said to himself, though in an audible tone, "Now for a little fun." Then began a contest that would have delighted and astonished a connoisseur in fencing. Such swift, lightning-like flashing of the blades, as they gave and parried cut and thrust. The clashing of the steel, the blue sparks that leaped from the contending swords as the fight grew more furious. Lampourde keeping up meanwhile an odd running commentary, as his wonder and admiration grew momentarily greater and more enthusiastic, and he had soon reached an exulting mood. Here at last was a foeman worthy of his steel, and he could not resist paying a tribute to the amazing skill that constantly and easily baffled his best efforts, in the shape of such extraordinary and original compliments that de Sigognac was mightily amused thereby. As usual, he was perfectly cool and self-possessed, keeping control of his temper as well as of his sword, though by this time he felt sure it was another agent of the Duke of Vallombreuse's he had to deal with, and that his life, not his cloak, was the matter at stake. At last Lampourde, who had begun to entertain an immense respect for his valiant opponent, could restrain his curiosity no longer, and eagerly asked, "Would it be indiscreet, sir, to inquire who was your instructor? Girolamo, Paraguante, or Cotte d'Astier would have reason to be proud of such a pupil. Which one of them was it?" "My only master was an old soldier, Pierre by name," answered de Sigognac, more and more amused at the oddities of the accomplished swordsman he was engaged with. "Stay, take that. It is one of his favourite strokes." "The devil!" cried Lampourde, falling back a step. I was very nearly done for, do you know. The point of your sword actually went through my sleeve and touched my arm. I felt the cold steel. Luckily for me it was not broad daylight. I should have been winged. But you are not accustomed, like me, to this dim, uncertain light for such work. All the same, it was admirably well done, and Jacquemin Lamport congratulates you upon it, sir. Now pay attention to me. I will not take any mean advantage of such a glorious foe as you are, and I give you fair warning that I am going to try on you my own secret and special thrust. The crowning glory of my art, the ne plus ultra of my science, the elixir of my life. It is known only to myself, and up to this time has been infallible. I have never failed to kill my man with it. If you can parry it, I will teach it to you. It is my only possession, and I will leave it to you if you survive it. Otherwise I will take my secret to the grave with me. I have never yet found anyone capable of executing it, unless indeed it be yourself. Admiral, incomparable swordsman that you are, it is a joy to meet such an one. But suppose we suspend hostilities a moment to take breath. So saying, Jacquemin Lampoud lowered the point of his sword, and de Sigognac did the same. They stood eyeing each other for a few moments with mutual admiration and curiosity, and then resumed the contest more fiercely than ever, each man doing his best, as he had need to do, and enjoying it. After a few passes, de Sigognac became aware that his adversary was preparing to give the decisive blow, and held himself on his guard against a surprise. When it came, delivered with terrible force, he parried it so successfully that Lamport's sword was broken short off in the encounter with his own trusty weapon, leaving only the hilt and a few inches of the blade in his hand. "If you have not got the rest of my sword in your body," cried Lamport excitedly, "you are a great man, a hero, a god." "No," de Sigognac replied calmly, "it did not touch me. And now, if I chose, I could pin you to the wall like a bat. But that would be repugnant to me, though you did waylay me to take my life, and besides you have really amused me with your droll sayings." "Baron," said Jacquemin Lamport calmly, "permit me, I humbly pray to you, to be henceforth, so long as I live, your devoted admirer, your slave, your dog. I was to be paid for killing you. I even received a portion of the money in advance, which I have spent. But never mind that. I will pay it back, every penny of it, though I must rob someone else to do it." With these words he picked up de Sigognac's cloak, and having put it carefully, even reverentially, over his shoulders, made him a profound obeisance, and departed. Thus the efforts of the Duke of Valambreuse to advance his suit and to get rid of his rival had once more failed ignominiously. End of section 14. Section 15 of Captain Fracas by Théophile Gautier, translated by Frédéric de Sumicrast. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Chapter 14. Lamport's Delicacy. It is easy to imagine the frame of mind in which the Duke of Valambreuse returned home after his repulse by Isabelle, and her rescue from his arms by the timely intervention of her friends, the comedians. At sight of his face, fairly livid and contorted with suppressed rage, his servants trembled and shrunk away from him. As well they might, for his natural cruelty was apt to vent itself upon the first unhappy dependent that happened to come in his way when his wrath was excited. He was not an easy master to serve, even in his most genial mood, this haughty, exacting young nobleman, and in his frantic fits of anger he was more savage and relentless than a half-starved tiger. Upon entering his own house he rushed through it like a whirlwind, shutting every door behind him with such a violent bang that the very walls shook, and pieces of the gilt mouldings round the panels were snapped off and scattered on the floor. When he reached his own room he flung down his hat with such force that it was completely flattened, and the feather broken short off. Then, unable to breathe freely, he tore open his rich velvet pourpoint as he rushed frantically to and fro, without any regard for the superb diamond buttons that fastened it, which flew in every direction. The exquisitely fine lace ruffles round his neck were reduced to shreds in a second, and with a vigorous kick he knocked over a large armchair that stood in his way, and left it upside down with its legs in the air. "The impudent little hussy," he cried, as he continued his frenzied walk, like a wild beast in a cage. "I have a great mind to have her thrown into prison, there to be well whipped, and have her hair shaved off before being sent to a lunatic asylum, or better still to some strict convent where they take in bad girls who have been forcibly rescued from lives of infamy. I could easily manage it. But no, it would be worse than useless. Persecution would only make her hate me more, and would not make her love that cursed de Sigognac a bit less. How can I punish her? What on earth shall I do? and still he paced restlessly to and fro, cursing and swearing and raving like a madman. While he was indulging in these transports of rage, without paying any attention to how the time was passing, evening drew on, and it was rapidly growing dark when his faithful Picard, full of commiseration, screwed up his courage to the highest point, and ventured to go softly in, though he had not been called and was disobeying orders, to light the candles in his master's room, thinking that he was quite gloomy enough already without being left in darkness as well, and hoping that the lights might help to make him more cheerful. They did seem to afford him some relief, in that they caused a diversion, for his thoughts, which had been all of Isabel and her cruel repulse of his passionate entreaties, suddenly flew to his successful rival, the Baron de Sigognac. "But how is this?" he cried, stopping short in his rapid pacing up and down the room. "How comes it that that miserable, degraded wretch has not been dispatched before this? I gave the most explicit orders about it to that good-for-nothing Mirandol. In spite of what Vidalenc says, I am convinced that I shall succeed with Isabel when once that cursed lover of hers is out of my way. She will be left entirely at my mercy then, and will have to submit to my will and pleasure with the best grace she can muster, for I shall not allow any sulking or tears. Doubtless she clings so obstinately to that confounded brute in the belief that she can induce him to marry her in the end. She means to be Madame la Baronne de Sigognac, the aspiring little actress. That must be the reason of all this mighty display of mock modesty, and of her venturing to repulse the attentions of a duke as scornfully, by Jove, as if he were a stable-boy. But she shall rue it, the impertinent little minx, and I'll have no mercy shown to the audacious scoundrel who dared to disable this right arm of mine. Hallo there! Send Mirandol up to me instantly, do you hear?" Picard flew to summon him, and in a few moments the discomfited bully made his appearance, pale from abject terror, with teeth chattering and limbs trembling, as he was ushered into the dread presence of his angry lord. In spite of his efforts to assume the sang-froid he was so far from feeling, he staggered like a drunken man, though he had not drank enough wine that day to drown a fly, and did not dare to lift his eyes to his master's face. "Well, you cowardly beast," said Valombreuse angrily, "how long, pray, are you going to stand there speechless like a stupid fool, with that hang-dog air, as if you already had the rope that you so richly deserve round your wicked neck?" "I only awaited your lordship's orders," stammered Mirandol, trying to appear at ease and failing lamentably. "My lord duke knows that I am entirely devoted to his service, even to being hanged if it seems good to your lordship." "Enough of that cant," interrupted the duke impatiently. "Didn't I charge you to have that cursed de Sigognac, otherwise Captain Fracas, cleared out of my way? You have not done it. My orders have not been obeyed. It is worth while, upon my word, to keep confounded hired rascals to do such work for me at this rate. All that you are good for is to stuff yourself in the kitchen, you dastardly beast, and to guzzle my good wine from morning until night. But I've had enough of this, by Jove, and if there is not a change, and that without any further loss of time, to the hangman you shall go. Do you hear? Just as sure as you stand there, gaping like a drivelling idiot." "My lord duke," said Mirandol in a trembling voice, "is unjust to his faithful servant, who desires nothing but to do his lord's bidding. But this Baron de Sigognac is not to be disposed of so easily as my lord believes. Never was there a braver, more fearless man. In our first attack on him at Poitiers he got the better of us in a most wonderful way. We never saw the like of it, and all he had to fight with was a dull, rusty sword not intended for use at all. A theatre sword, just for looks. And when we tried to do for him here in Paris, the very night he got here, it all came to naught, because he was so watchful, and somehow suspected what we were up to, and was ready for us. And that upset our beautiful little plan entirely. I never was so surprised in my life. And there was nothing for us to do, the whole four of us, but to get out of his sight as fast as we could, and he's standing there laughing at us. Oh, he's a rare one, is Captain Fracas. And now he knows my face, so I can't go near him myself. But I have engaged the services of a particular friend of mine, the bravest man and the best fighter in Paris. He hasn't his equal in the world with the sword, they all say. He is lying in wait for him on the Pont Neuf now, at this very moment, and there'll be no mistake this time. Lamporde will be sure to dispatch him for us, if it is not done already, and that without the slightest danger of your lordship's name being mixed up with the affair in any way, as it might have been if your lordship's own servants had done it." "The plan is not a bad one," said the young duke, somewhat mollified, "and perhaps it is better that it should be done in that way. But are you really sure of the courage and skill of this friend of yours? He will need both to get the better of that confounded de Sigognac, who is no coward, and a master hand with a sword, I am bound to acknowledge, though I do hate him like the devil." "My lord need have no fears," said Mirandol enthusiastically, being now more at his ease. Jacquemin Lamport is a hero, a wonder, as everybody will tell your lordship. He is more valiant than Achilles, or the great Alexander. He is not spotless, certainly, like the Chevalier Bayard, but he is fearless." Picard, who had been hovering about for a few minutes in an uneasy way, now seeing that his master was in a better humour, approached and told him that a very odd-looking man was below, who asked to see him immediately on most important business. "You may bring him in," said the Duke, "but just warn him, Picard, that if he dares to intrude upon me for any trifling matter, I'll have him skinned alive before I let him go." Arundel was just about leaving the room when the entrance of the newcomer rooted him to the spot. He was so astonished and alarmed that he could not move hand or foot. And no wonder, for it was no other than the hero whose name he had just spoken, Jacquemin Lamport in person, and the bare fact of his having dared to penetrate so boldly into the dread presence of that high and mighty seigneur, the Duke of Vallombreuse, ignoring entirely the agent through whom his services had been engaged, showed of itself that something very extraordinary must have taken place. Lamport himself did not seem to be in the least disconcerted, and after winking at his friend furtively in a very knowing way, stood unabashed before the Duke, with the bright light of the many wax candles shining full upon his face. There was a red mark across his forehead, where his hat had been pressed down over it, and great drops of sweat stood on it, as if he had been running fast or exercising violently. His eyes, of a bluish-grey tint, with a sort of metallic lustre in them, were fixed upon those of the haughty young nobleman, with a calm insolence that made Marandol's blood run cold in his veins. His large nose, whose shadow covered all one side of his face, as the shadow of Mount Etna covers a considerable portion of the island of Sicily, stood out prominently, almost grotesquely, in profile. His moustache, with its long stiff points carefully waxed, which produced exactly the effect of an iron skewer stuck through his upper lip, and the royal on his chin curled upward, like a comma turned the wrong way, all contributed to make up a very extraordinary physiognomy, such as caricaturists dote on. He wore a large scarlet cloak, wrapped closely about his erect, vigorous form, and in one hand, which he extended towards the Duke, he held suspended a well-filled purse, a strange and mysterious proceeding which Mirandol could by no means understand. "Well, you rascal," said the Duke, after staring for a moment in astonishment at this odd-looking specimen, "what does this mean? Are you offering arms to me, pray, or what, with your purse there held out at arm's length, apparently for my acceptance?" "In the first place, my lord Duke," said Lamport, with perfect sang-froid and gravity, "may it not displease your highness, but I am not a rascal. My name is Jacquemin Lamport, and I ply the sword for a living. My profession is an honourable one. I have never degraded myself by taking part in trade of any kind, or by manual labour. Killing is my business, at the risk of my own life and limb, for I always do my work alone, unaided, armed only with my trusty sword. Fair play is a jewel, and I would scorn to take a mean advantage of anybody. I have always given warning before I attack a man, and let him have a chance to defend himself, having a horror of treachery and cowardly sneaking ways. What profession could be more noble than mine, pray? I am no common brutal assassin, my lord Duke, and I beseech your lordship to take back that offensive epithet, which I could never accept save in a friendly, joking way. It outrages too painfully the sensitive delicacy of my amour propre, my lord." "Very well, so be it, Maître Jacquemin Lamport, since you desire it," answered Vallombreuse, very much amused at the oddity of his strange visitor. "And now have the goodness to explain your business here, with a purse in your hand, that you certainly appear to be steadily offering to me." Jacquemin, satisfied by this concession to his susceptibility, suddenly jerked his head forward, without bending his body, while he waved the hat that he held slowly to and fro, making, according to his ideas, a salute that was a judicious mingling of the soldiers and the courtiers, which ceremony being concluded, he proceeded as follows with his explanation. "Here is the whole thing in a nutshell, my lord Duke. I received from Marandol, acting for your lordship, part payment in advance for dispatching a certain Baron de Sigognac, commonly called Captain Fracas. On account of circumstances beyond my control, I have not been able to finish the job, and as I am a great stickler for honesty and honour also, I have hastened to bring back to you, my lord Duke, the money that I did not earn." With these words he advanced a step, and with a gesture that was not devoid of dignity, gently laid the purse down on a beautiful Florentine mosaic table that stood at the Duke's elbow. "Verily," said Vallombreuse sneeringly, "we seem to have here one of those droll bullies who are good for naught but to figure in a comedy. An ass in a lion's skin, whose roar is nothing worse than a bray. Come, my man, own up frankly that you were afraid of that same de Sigognac." "'Jacquemin Lamport has never been afraid of anybody in his life,' the fighting man replied, drawing himself up haughtily, "'and no adversary has ever seen his back. Those who know me will tell your lordship that easy victories have no charm for me. I love danger and court it. I take positive delight in it. I attacked the Baron de Sigognac at Secundum Artem, and with one of my very best swords, made by Alonso de Sahagun, the elder of Toledo.' "'Well, and what happened then?' said the young duke eagerly. "'It would seem that you could not have been victorious, since you wished to refund this money which was to pay you for dispatching him.' First, let me inform your highness that in the course of my duels and combats, of one sort and another, I have left no less than 37 men stretched dead upon the ground, and that without counting in all those that I have wounded mortally or crippled for life. But this Baron de Sigognac entrenched himself within a circle of flashing steel, as impenetrable as the walls of a granite fortress.' I called into requisition all the resources of my art against him, and tried in every possible way to surprise him off his guard, but he was ready for everything, as quick as a flash, as firm as a rock. He parried every thrust triumphantly, magnificently, with the most consummate science and a grace and ease I have never seen equalled. He kept me busy defending myself too all the time, and more than once had nearly done for me. His audacity was astonishing, his sang-froid superb, and his perfect mastery over his sword, and his temper sublime. He was not a man, but a god. I could have fallen down and worshipped him. At the risk of being spitted on his sword, I prolonged the fight as much as I dared, so as to enjoy his marvellous, glorious, unparalleled method to the utmost. However, there had to be an end of it, and I thought I was sure of dispatching him at last by means of a secret I possess, an infallible and very difficult thrust, taught and bequeathed to me by the great Girolamo of Naples, my beloved master. No man living has a knowledge of it but myself. There is no one else left capable of executing it to perfection, and upon that depends its success. Well, my lord duke, Girolamo himself could not have done it better than I did to-night. I was thunderstruck when my opponent did not go down before it as if he had been shot. I expected to see him lying dead at my feet. But not at all, by Jove. That devil of a Captain Fracas parried my blow with dazzling swiftness, and with such force that my blade was broken short off, and I left completely at his mercy, with nothing but the stump in my hand. See here, my lord duke, just look at what he did to my precious, priceless Sahagun. And Jacquemin Lamport, with a piteous air, drew out and exhibited the sorry remains of his trusty sword, almost weeping over it, and calling the duke's attention to the perfectly straight and even break. Your highness can see that it was a prodigious blow that snapped this steel like a pipe stem, and it was done with such ease and precision. To dispatch Captain Fracas by fair means is beyond my skill, my lord duke, and I would scorn to resort to treachery. Like all truly brave men, he is generous. I was left entirely defenceless, and he could have spit at me like an ortolan just by extending his arm, but he refrained. He let me go unscathed. A miraculous display of delicacy, as well as chivalrous generosity, from a gentleman assaulted in the gloaming on the Pont Neuf. I owe my life to him, and moreover such a debt of gratitude as I shall never be able to repay. I cannot undertake anything more against him, my lord duke. Henceforth he is sacred to me. Besides, it would be a pity to destroy such a swordsman. Good ones are rare in these degenerate days, and growing more so every year. I don't believe he has his equal on earth. Most men handle a sword as if it were a broomstick nowadays, and then expect to be praised and applauded, the clumsy, stupid fools. Now I have given my reasons for coming to inform your highness that I must resign the commission I had accepted. As for the money there, I might perhaps have been justified in keeping it, to indemnify me for the great risk and peril I incurred, but such a questionable proceeding would be repugnant to my tender conscience and my honest pride, as your highness can understand. "'In the name of all the devils in the infernal regions, take back your money,' cried Vallombreuse impetuously, "'or I will have you pitched out of the window yonder, you and your money both. I never heard of such a scrupulous scoundrel in my life. You, Mirandol, and your cursed crew—' have not a spark of honour or honesty among you all. Far enough from it. Then perceiving that Lamport hesitated about picking up the purse, he added, Take it, I tell you. I give it to you to drink my health with. In that, my lord duke, you shall be religiously obeyed, Lamport replied joyfully. However, I do not suppose that your highness will object to my dedicating part of it to Lansquenet. And he stretched out his long arm, seized the purse, and with one dexterous movement, like a juggler, chucked it jingling into the depths of his pocket. "'It is understood, then, my lord duke, that I retire from the affair so far as the Baron de Sigognac is concerned,' continued Lamport. "'But if agreeable to your highness, it will be taken in hand by my alter ego, the Chevalier Malartic, who is worthy to be entrusted with the most delicate and hazardous enterprises, because of his remarkable adroitness and superior ability. And he was one of the best fellows in the world into the bargain. I had sketched out a scheme for the abduction of the young actress, in whom your Highness condescends to take an interest, which Malartic will now carry out, with all the wonderful perfection of detail that characterizes his clever way of doing things. Mirandol here, who knows him, will testify to his rare qualifications, my Lord Duke, and you could not find a better man for your purpose. I am presenting a real treasure to your lordship in tendering Malartic's services. When he is wanted, your Highness has only to send a trusty messenger to mark a cross in chalk on the left-hand doorpost of the Crowned Radish. Malartic will understand and repair at once, in proper disguise, to this house to receive your lordship's last orders. Having finished this triumphant address, Maître Jacquemin Lampoule again saluted the Duke as before, then put his hat on his head and stalked majestically out of the room, exceedingly well satisfied with his own eloquence and what he considered courtly grace in the presence of so illustrious a nobleman. His oddity and originality, together with his strange mingling of lofty notions of honour and rascality, had greatly amused and interested the young Duke of Valombreuse, who was even willing to forgive him for not having dispatched de Sigognac. For if even this famous professional duellist could not get the better of him, he really must be invincible, and in consequence the thought of his own defeat became less galling and intolerable to his pride and vanity. Moreover, he had not been able to get rid of an uncomfortable consciousness, even in his most angry mood, that his endeavouring to compass de Sigognac's assassination was rather too great an enormity, not only on account of any conscientious scruples, but simply because his rival was a gentleman. He would not have hesitated a second about having half a dozen bourgeois murdered, if they had been rash or unfortunate enough to interfere with him, the blood of such base, ignoble creatures being of no more consequence in his eyes than so much water. Valombreuse would have liked to dispatch his enemy himself in honourable combat, but that was rendered impossible by the Baron's superior ability as a swordsman, of which he still had a painful reminder in his wounded arm, which was scarcely healed yet, and would prevent his indulging in anything like a duel for some time to come. So his thoughts turned to the abduction of the young actress, a pleasanter subject to dwell upon, as he felt not the slightest doubt that once he had her to himself, separated from de Sigognac and her companions, she would not long be able to withstand his eloquent pleading and personal attractions. His self-conceit was boundless, but not much to be wondered at, considering his invariable and triumphant success in affairs of gallantry. So in spite of his recent repulse, he flattered himself that he only required a fitting opportunity to obtain from Isabelle all that he desired. "Let me have her for a few days in some secluded place," said he to himself, "where she cannot escape from me, or have any intercourse with her friends, and I shall be sure to win her heart. I shall be so kind and good and considerate to her, treat her with so much delicacy and devotion, that she cannot help feeling grateful to me, and then the transition to love will be easy and natural. But when once I have won her, made her wholly mine, then she shall pay dearly for what she has made me suffer. Yes, my lady, I mean to have my revenge. You may rest assured of that." End of section 15.